From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Is war, as we know it, going out of style? Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Conventional wisdom has it that warfare has become increasingly deadly, with dire predictions of massive casualties to come. But in the past year, 10 years, battle-rated deaths were half those of the 1990s, a third of those in the Cold War, and a hundredth of those during World War II. Today we'll hear that Iraq might have been the last place where massive national armies will clash on a battlefield. Will trade be a better way for countries to get what they want? Will armed conflicts be smaller and more high-tech? Does peace have a chance? Warren Olney back with To the Point. The Pentagon is working to cut $450 billion over the next 10 years, and the failure of the Supercommittee on Deficit Reduction may add $600 billion more. Defense Department officials call that catastrophic, but warfare is changing in some very surprising ways. Joshua Goldstein is Professor Emeritus of International Relations at American University in Washington, and he's co-author most recently of Winning the War on War, The Decline of Armed Conflict Worldwide. Professor Goldstein, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be here with you.
You have written in Foreign Policy magazine that although it appears that the early 21st century seems awash in wars, in fact, the battlefield deaths are in fact going down and have been doing so since World War II. Can you give us some statistics?
Sure. Of course, the United States has had a nasty decade of war here that we're just coming off of, so that's why we all feel that things are getting worse. But worldwide, if you count the number of battle deaths, that's military and civilian killed directly by war violence, be it suicide bombs, airstrikes, bullets, etc., those numbers are down in this past decade to a third of what they were during the Cold War on average, and half of what they were in the 1990s. So there's a definite downward trend in the number of people dying in wars. And the big difference in today's world compared to history, all of history, is that big national armies, the regular armies with their tanks and artillery and submarines and airplanes and all, are not fighting each other head to head. Nowhere in the world today are those armies fighting each other head to head. And this is very new historically and a big development.
What are the prospects that they might in the future? Which countries might do it and which might not? And is there a possibility that one might break out?
Well, there's always a possibility one might break out. So I'm not going to tell you that that's impossible. It could happen. The trend could reverse. But the last time that this happened, serious head-to-head fighting of national armies, was back in 2003, 8 years ago, when we invaded Iraq. Places that in the past might have broken out into full-scale war don't seem to do so anymore. And I'll give you an example, the Thailand-Cambodia border dispute. It's been going on for centuries, and it's heated up in the last few years, and there's been some skirmishing between those two armies, regular national armies. But it didn't break into all-out war, partly because the World Court came in and laid down some rulings that the countries actually followed, and partly because both those countries value prosperity. And this is, of course, all the more true of a country like China and really the whole world. You get ahead with trade these days, not by conquering land. And if you're trying to engage with a global trading system, war is not what you want. This is not the way to get ahead anymore.
You made these comparisons. One-third in the recent decade, one-third of what it was in the Cold War, one-half of what it was in the 1990s. How does it compare to World War II?
About a hundredth of World War II. I mean, remember, World War II, we bombed, firebombed German and Japanese cities, killing tens of thousands of civilians in a night, and that's what the good guys did. You know, the Germans and Japanese atrocities were far worse than that. I mean, millions killed, countries, whole continents reduced to ruins. This just hasn't happened ever since.
So what are you confident to say that it's not likely to happen again? Nobody can predict the future. As you said earlier, anything is possible. How optimistic are you?
Well, guardedly optimistic. I think that war is very deeply seated in our human nature, and also conflicts are going to be around forever. You know, countries will always be in conflict about, you know, competition over resources, ethnic conflicts, you name it. But we have new tools that we haven't had historically. Specifically, the United Nations and peacekeeping have been much more successful than people usually give them credit for. And so using these new tools and the changing attitudes about war, where it's no longer seen as glorious but seen as pretty horrible, countries are moving away from war as the best way to settle their disputes. And for instance, not a single member of the United Nations has ever gone out of business by being conquered in the whole history of the UN. And that's a change from history, where countries would come and go and get overrun all the time.
This, of course, raises questions about the Defense Department and the amount of money that we spend on military hardware and personnel. Once again, the Super Committee on Deficit Reduction failed to do its job. That means another $600 million might be cut from the Pentagon, in addition to the $450 million that's now being looked at. The Defense Secretary Leon Panetta says that would leave a smaller force than at any time since 1940.
A hollow military has the organizational structure, but lacks the people, the training, and the equipment it needs to actually get the job done. It's a ship without sailors. It's a brigade without bullets. It's an air wing without enough trained pilots. It's a paper tiger.
Again, the Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta. Fred Kaplan is national security columnist for Slate.com. He's senior Schwartz fellow at the New
York Credit for some crudes about credit war.
Writing a book on the military strategy. And Fred Kaplan, it's good to have you back on our program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
What do you say to what we heard from Joshua Goldstein about the fact that war seems to, or the world, let's put it this way, seems to be a less violent place than it was?
Well, I have to confess I have not read his book, although I do plan to. It sounds fascinating and intriguing, and it deals with some of these big issues, kind of macro historical issues that often get lost in looking at, this year compared with last year. I would throw out the following caveats, though. Number one, the lobbing of one nuclear missile by one country onto another city could throw off the calculations completely. Could wreck everything. Could produce more deaths in an afternoon than several wars have done over a period of some years, and that's something that I think many people think that the nuclear era is over. Among superpowers, yes. Other countries, it may just be beginning. That remains to be seen. But there is one thing. It is true that technology has improved things a lot in this regard. It used to be 30 years ago, if there was a target in the middle of a city that a commander wanted to destroy, he basically had to attack the city, killing lots of people in the process. Now, some of these, the missiles fired by these drones and other aircraft are so small and yet so accurate, coming within 10 feet of the target through guidance from GPS satellite systems, that you could hit the target right in the middle of an area and kill almost nobody. I mean, the kinds of casualties that people are talking about in Iraq and Afghanistan, while horrendous and not to be downplayed whatsoever, are a pittance compared with the kinds of civilian and military casualties that we face daily in Vietnam, for instance.
So what about what we just heard then from the Secretary of Defense? Do we need more than what he referred to as a hollow military?
Well, I Panetta is puzzling me, I must say. I don't know what he's talking about. Yes, if you blindly cut the military budget just by reducing everything by a certain percentage, which is what the sequester would do, yeah, he
the
might have
the sequester is what came out of the failure of the supercommittee. Go ahead.
Well, it doesn't take effect for another year, so right. things could be changed between now and then. But there are ways to shrewdly cut the defense budget. The defense budget right now, which he says, even if the cuts, it's an absolute dollar figure, even if those cuts went into place, the U.S. military budget would still be considerably higher than it was in the final years of the Cold War, when all of Europe was an armed garrison. Or the West and East German borders. We're not facing the Soviet Union. There's not a nuclear arms race going on. Do we really need all the divisions that we have? Do we really need to keep spending $20 billion a year on nuclear weapons? Do we really need another aircraft carrier? These kinds of questions No, but if you just looked at the defense budget, if you would, if somebody had gone to sleep 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and woken up today and said, I wonder what's going on in the world, let me look at the defense budget, a quick look at the defense budget would lead him to believe that the Cold War is still going on. It's dominated mainly by aircraft carriers, large ships, fighter jets. There's a lot of serious from bottom-up thinking that could be done to the defense budget where we could strengthen our security in terms of the kinds of threats we're likely to face at much, much lower price tag.
We're going to examine that issue further a bit later in the program. Before we do, I want to go back to Joshua Goldstein, our first guest, and ask the question about one nuclear missile, which, as Fred Kaplan pointed out, could do more damage, more killing than many wars combined in one afternoon. You're not saying that's no longer a risk.
No, he's completely right about that, and I also worry about one nuclear weapon getting into the wrong hands. That's something we should be worried about and concerned about. But in the historical perspective, I'm in the generation that grew up putting our heads under the desk to be ready for the end of the world, a nuclear global war with tens of thousands of weapons on each side. And in the last 30 years, three-quarters of those weapons have been taken offline and destroyed. So we've reduced our world's arsenal of nuclear weapons by three-quarters. Now, that's not low enough. It doesn't mean we should stop worrying, but we're clearly moving in the right direction with nukes.
What about all the concern about Iran and, of course, Pakistan and India?
Well, these are conflicts that have a tendency they could go violent. Iran is a big problem that we need to keep our eye on. Now, does that mean that coming in with all those heavy formations and divisions and tanks and fighter jets is going to solve that problem? I don't think so. The Stuxnet virus was the only thing that's been very effective so far, and that didn't involve killing anybody. India and Pakistan have been on a better path since about a decade ago when they almost went to war, realized that it would very likely go nuclear and that millions of people would be killed, and said, this is crazy. So they've been stabilizing relations since then, although it's not what you would desire.
Fred Kaplan, do you think there's a chance of a land war in Iran, or what about China?
With U.S. forces?
Yes.
No, it'd be insane. Iran is, you know, three times the size of Iraq. There was the notion that that would be a cakewalk. You know, 10 years later, we're finally getting out of there. And the political problems that began at the beginning of the occupation are still very much in play. I don't think anybody, you could go to all the right-wing think tanks you want in search of someone who's in favor of invading Iran, and I don't think you would find him. China, you know, I don't buy the idea that there's going to be a war, but if it is, it's going to be one that would involve air and sea. Nobody's going to go invading China. On the nuclear problem, the thing that worries me is not so much the number of weapons, but and not even U.S. and Russia, but, you know, the United States and the United States and Russian capitals were, you know, a half-hour missile time away from one another. You could look at radar, early warning radar systems. There were times when there were false alerts. You know, a flock of geese was mistaken for a flock of missiles. But there was some time to work this out. Both sides also had a hotline in place. There were locks on the smaller nuclear weapons so that unauthorized people couldn't fire them. You have a situation where Iran and Israel or Iran and Saudi Arabia have nuclear weapons aimed at each other. You've got 4 or 5 minutes for a commander to decide whether or not what's showing up on his radar screen is really a nuclear missile or some kind of mistake. You've got, perhaps no tradition of things like hotlines and permissive action links. It's a much more unstable situation, even if one side or the other didn't want to start a nuclear war. If they think that the other side might be about to strike first, they might be tempted to strike first preemptively.
You indicated, Fred Kaplan, that we could cut the budget comfortably. Joshua Goldstein, quickly before we need to go to a break, tell us, do you think that 400 plus 600 billion is too much?
Yes, I think it's too much. It's way above what we were spending in the 1990s, and the world is becoming more peaceful than it was in the 1990s.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was talking about the cuts. Are we looking at too many cuts?
Oh, no. I think that the cuts have to be done in a careful way. As Fred Kaplan said, you know, if you hollow out the force, it's not going to be pretty. That's Mr. Panetta's job, to figure out how to make these cuts in a sensible way. So you could have 11 aircraft carriers with no sailors on them. That would be pretty stupid, but maybe we can get by with 8 or 9 aircraft carriers with their sailors. And I think that with some thought that goes into the process, we can adapt the military away from these heavy formations and away from the very extremely high levels of spending and bring it into reality. They can always do more with more money, so that's not in question. But it's a trade-off with other things that the society wants to do.
Well, we're not only back with To the Point, talking today about the fact that the world has become less violent as far as deaths due to war are concerned, all the way back since World War II. It is unlikely, according to our current guests, that nation states will engage in conflicts, particularly that the United States will engage in the kind of conflict it engaged in Iraq, and that nations have in the past with massive armies clashing on the battlefield. So why do we need the tanks? Why do we need the aircraft carriers? Why do we need so many jets? Michael O'Hanlon is military analyst and senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. He's author of the Wounded Giant, America's Armed Forces in an Age of Austerity. Michael O'Hanlon, good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren. Nice to be with you.
Age of Austerity, and the Wounded Giant, you're suggesting that maybe Secretary Panetta is right.
Well, the Wounded Giant comes from the basic idea that we have a broken economy and that we do have to fix it, and that means everybody, including the Pentagon, has to chip in. So I begin with the premise that, agreeing with Joshua and Fred, we do need to rethink where we are today. But what I try to do in this book is to basically sketch out what I think a reasonable alternative U.S. military strategy would be. And then instead of arguing from the top down, we have this high of a budget today compared to the Cold War, compared to other countries, I try to essentially calculate the savings from my various recommended cutbacks. And I wind up feeling you can easily, or not easily, but certainly you can feasibly cut the $400 billion that's mandated over 10 years by the August round of cuts under the Budget Control Act. But I do not like sequestration. I don't see how you can responsibly make those cuts. Now, there's plenty of room to continue the debate, and maybe there are ways to achieve economies that I haven't yet thought of in the book. But I try to take the point of view, and I'll explain in a second sort of my strategic thinking behind that very briefly, but the point of view that unless I can explain the cut, calculate the savings from the cut, I don't want to just wave my hands and claim that we can make $1 trillion 10-year savings. And I'll give you one example of the kind of fairly significant change that's in the book. I think we should go from a two-war planning framework to a one-war planning framework for the ground forces, for the U.S. Army and Marine Corps, and then have some additional capacity for multinational stabilization missions, maybe a couple at a time or up to a couple at a time as well. I'm not advocating we carry all those out at once, but I think recent history would suggest we have some interest in places in the world that are unstable today. And just one last broader point, Warren, if I might, I really admire Josh's book, and I think it conveys a generally accurate sense of where war has gone. And I think he would agree, he's not the first person to detect some of these trends. And some of the previous explanations have been that actually the world benefits when there's a pretty strong leader and a pretty strong alliance system, the Western alliance system, that creates a certain level of deterrence and a certain level of stability. So as we cut, I think we have to remember part of what explains the reduction in the popularity of warfare and not assume that it's a given. I'm not implying that Joshua Goldstein has said that, but I'm just saying for the broader discussion, we need to remember that there may actually be a role for the U.S.-led alliance system in preserving that very stability that we're now at risk of taking a little bit for granted.
If we want to switch from a two-war to a one-war strategy, what's the one war? What's the most likely to occur? Our other guests said they didn't think there was one.
Well, I would give you a few, and bear in mind, none of these would I describe as likely, just as very few analysts, if you had had a show in 2000 or early 2001, would have described Afghanistan as likely either. I still think it's not out of the question that if things really went badly, we could wind up in another problem in Korea. And it might not be because of a North Korean attack on the South. It could be because of an escalation of small attack leading to bigger attack, to larger attack, back and forth between the two Koreas. It could also be because of the collapse of the North Korean regime, with then the security of its nuclear arsenal being at risk, and there being some imperative for the United States to help stabilize the peninsula as quickly as possible. That would be probably Exhibit A. I also would take it would note there are a couple of cases or scenarios that might be somewhere between war and a very difficult stabilization mission. And one of the ones that might build on the earlier conversation that I would mention is, let's say India and Pakistan do go to war again. And by the way, Pakistan still supports or tolerates Lashkar-e-Taiba, the group that carried out the Mumbai attacks in 2008. So we are not into a happy period that we can take for granted in Indo-Pakistani relations by any means. There's still a possibility of another war. And if that happened, I could easily imagine a scenario where one or both countries use a nuclear weapon against, let's say, an airfield on the other side. And then there's the risk of these very population strikes that Fred and Joshua were alluding to a few minutes ago as a terrible thing that could change all of these trends we've been discussing. Under that kind of situation, I don't claim the United States would fight its way into South Asia to knock heads together and get these countries to stop fighting. But I do think there's the possibility that, for example, there might be an international peace operation that India and Pakistan would agree to because they recognize that otherwise they were likely to wind up in an all-out nuclear war. And that might have to take control of the Kashmir region that's, of course, disputed between India and Pakistan and explains a lot of their wars, and control that, stabilize that, maybe run it as a trusteeship for a number of years. That's the kind of mission that's somewhere between war and peace that I think we better be careful not to rule out. I'm not predicting it. I don't think it's likely. But if you go around the world and look at a few other trouble spots, chances are one of these sort of ugly things might very well play out in the coming couple of decades.
So let me go back to our other guest. First, Fred Kaplan, would we be unprepared if we cut $1 trillion out of the Pentagon budget to deal with that kind of situation, or one of those hypotheses?
Well, again, it depends how the cuts are made. You know, a lot of people, there's still this reluctance to make any kinds of cuts because, well, you know, our commanders, our generals, they know what the national security is. In many ways, though, the Pentagon is a bureaucracy. Warren, if you go back and look at defense budgets going back all the way to the mid-60s, and if you divide them between how much goes to the Army, how much goes to the Navy, how much goes to the Air Force, it is just about exactly one-third, one-third, one-third. It never varies by more than 2% over the last 45 years. Now, you can infer one of two things from that. You can infer that the people who set up the current Defense Department and the Division of Roles and Missions back in 1947 were even more prescient and brilliant than the founding fathers of the 1770s, or you can infer that the Pentagon is a bureaucracy. And in order to prevent the inter-service rivalry that plagued the military in the 1950s, the chiefs have come to a solution where they basically split the budget three ways. It doesn't mean that everything in that three-way split is really needed for the national security.
Let me go back to Joshua Goldstein. Do you think that the kind of scenarios that we just heard from Michael O'Hanlon, those specific scenarios, are places where the United Nations could do the job instead of the U.S.? And even if that were the case, wouldn't the United States have to be the one to supply much of the military necessity to the U.N.?
Well, I agree with Michael O'Hanlon that we don't want to cut drastically and abruptly because that creates power vacuums and instabilities in the system, which we don't need right now just as things are improving and getting more stable. So we want to do this in a thoughtful and phased way. But United Nations peacekeeping does do things that we can't do. There's other things that we, our military, can do that it can't do, but there are places the peacekeeping is more effective than a bunch of U.S. tanks. And it's way cheaper, partly because we hire people from poor countries to do the peacekeeping, and it's much more expensive, as Michael O'Hanlon has described how expensive it is to put like NATO troops out there instead of Bangladeshi peacekeepers. But the average American household, the bottom line is, pays $2 a month for UN peacekeeping and almost $700 a month for our military and veterans benefits. So that's a huge disparity. And the idea that we could take a little bit of the military, you know, a modest little cut, and you could do big things with peacekeeping with that amount of money. So I think that this is an area we should be developing, putting more resources into. And when peacekeeping has been successful, it's been because it had enough people, enough money, which it rarely does. And then they're able to do great things and keep wars from dragging on and on.
Do you agree with Michael O'Hanlon, then, that the world benefits when there's a strong alliance system and that the United States ought to stay strong in order to maintain that?
Well, as a general principle, I do agree with that. Now, in this past decade, I think we overdid it because it ended up that most of the war going on in the world was Iraq and Afghanistan, where we were the ones involved in it. But as a general principle, having a strong United States, being engaged with our allies, being out there engaged in the world and with military force to back it up is a good idea. I think the recent operation in Libya was an example of doing everything right that we got wrong in Iraq. So we worked through the United Nations, we worked with our NATO allies, we were able to win rather quickly, we didn't put our troops on the ground and so forth. And that may be a model for the future, where multinational, getting others to share the expense with us and not going in with a bunch of ground forces to invade someplace.
Michael O'Hanlon, do you agree with that about Libya?
Yes, and sorry you're getting your guests to all agree with each other and say things about
that's
each other,
all right.
But, you know, it's the holidays, so what can we do?
Exactly, and it's a holiday in one case dedicated to peace on earth.
Exactly, and I want to come in behind Josh's point and say I firmly agree, and I'm a little biased here because I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Congo, which is one of the countries in the world, and just had an election, of course, which probably didn't go very well, but one of the countries in the world still most torn by violence, where the idea that the United States or even NATO is going to come in and save the day is pretty implausible. And therefore, our best hope to see progress there is greater UN capability. And there are various things the United States could be doing to improve that, both at a broad political level, recognizing these missions can be successful and are efficient, but also at a more practical level, helping some of the participating countries with the capabilities they need, better training, better ground equipment, better logistics, not big tanks and fighter jets, but the mundane stuff to make them more effective in the field. And, you know, I wouldn't want to rule out the possibility that in a couple of years we consider sending a couple of battalions at least to this sort of a mission too. But the more practical thing, even if we were to do that, it should be done through UN auspices. And that's where the violence in the world still is quite severe, is in places like Congo, maybe Sudan, maybe Somalia, where we've got a couple of African friends doing a pretty admirable job in tough circumstances, and yet there's still a huge risk of famine. Those are the places where the risk and the reality of combat death remains very high, and where the UN is going to be a better answer in most scenarios that I can think of than American power.
We heard a moment ago Joshua Goldstein say that the Stuxnet computer virus seems to be the only thing that's worked with regard to Iran. Let's talk a bit about the technology of the future and very specifically cybersecurity. James Lewis is Senior Fellow and Director of the Commission on Cybersecurity at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. It's good to have you back on our program. Thanks for
joining us. Hi, Warren. How are you?
Very well. Thank you. Chime in here about cyber war and what it entails and how expensive it is.
Well, we usually get it wrong when we discuss it because we focus on things like Stuxnet, which was an attack on critical infrastructure. It had some success, not clear how much, may not have worked as well as the people who wrote it wanted. But I think when you see militaries using this stuff, they'll have a very different target. One of the biggest trends in warfare for really the last 20 years has been the use of networks and technology and information to improve combat performance. And our opponents will try and degrade U.S. capabilities, will try and degrade theirs. So you're not going to see attacks on critical infrastructure in a conflict. You're going to see attacks on information systems and on commanders. It's a very different kind of war. And one of the troubles I think we're having is envisioning what conflict will look like in the future. We've talked about the likelihood of it. We've talked about the cost. And just as a footnote, the biggest problem for DOD now is personnel costs, not buying new weapons, not maintaining the weapons we have. And that's a political issue. But then when we talk about could some country miscalculate, including the U.S., could we find ourselves in a shooting war, what will that look like? And in that, cyber will be a supporting weapon, important, but it won't be the only weapon.
So you don't think, then, that warfare will be one country trying to take out the other country's electrical system?
It's not worth it. I mean, you could do that now with a missile or an aircraft or a commando team. What do you get out of it? Military commanders will do the same kind of calculation that they always do. How does this help me? Does it risk escalating the conflict? What are the downsides? And what they're going to come to is theater use of cyber weapons against your deployed opponent, very attractive, almost 100% certain in any conflict. But if you were to, say, find a conflict in the Taiwan Straits or with the Russians in Georgia, it would be a major escalation for them to hit targets in the U.S. with cyber weapons. And they might not want to do that because you never know how the Americans will respond. We'll probably go through the same kind of calculation. What is the thing that would get us the most benefit at the lowest cost and the lowest risk? And hitting somebody's critical infrastructure, you know, we did that in World War II. We may not do that in whatever the next conflict will be.
Why is taking out the electrical system, as you indicated, not worth it? You wouldn't kill a lot of people, presumably, at least not right off. Obviously, the absence of electricity might have fatal consequences for lots of people. And what about the idea of getting into some other nation's nuclear capacity or some other of their necessary activities? Isn't that one of the possibilities for cyber war?
You know, one of the things you want to ask yourself is, again, how much benefit do I get out of this? Is this going to help me win the conflict? Is it going to hurt my opponent? And one of the things we might face is that clashes in the future might be smaller, sharper, faster. They're going to be what some people call come-as-you-are wars. Again, not, you know, multi-year things that involve major forces. And so turning off the electrical power is not going to stop the ability of the U.S. to deploy military forces or to use them or even to supply them in the near term. And so you would not get that much benefit out of doing it. I mean, if you're going to have a fight over Georgia, you could turn out the lights and it wouldn't have any effect. We turn out the lights here in Washington all the time, thanks to one of our local power companies. No one ever notices, right? So that's what commanders are going to do. They're going to ask themselves, I have a new way to attack. Where do I get real benefit from it? The nuclear thing is a little more interesting, but I think it's harder to do. And a good example of that might be the rather hilarious Iranian claims to have hacked into one of our drones. It's hard to do. And if it's hard to do to a drone, it's going to be even harder to do for nuclear weapons. So a risk, sure. Do we need to think about it? Yes. But again, put this in the context of routine military operations. Where do I get a benefit that is more than simply annoying my opponent?
You find the Iranian claim hilarious?
Yeah, I mean they tend to make things up. Everyone remembers a couple years ago when they distributed photos of one of their missile tests and had photoshopped in some extra missiles, and that kind of speaks to their veracity.
What about civilian vulnerability in the future, as you see the future of warfare?
You know, I think one of the things that we'll have to worry about, and this is probably more on the cyber side, is the, I don't know what you want to call it, the proliferation of cyber attack techniques, or maybe the commoditization of cyber attack techniques. So a big power, a Russia or a China, they're going to think twice about striking domestic targets, civilian targets in the U.S. But an anarchist group or jihadis, they might be more tempted. So what we could see is a lot more of a problem from non-state actors. And one of the changes in focus that we've seen since 2003 is the U.S. military having to think a lot more about how does it deter, detect, or destroy non-state actors. And that will be one of the big focuses for future conflict.
We're just about out of time, unfortunately, with Jim Lewis at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Let's start, or rather end, where we began with Joshua Goldstein, author of Winning the War on War, The Decline of Armed Conflict Worldwide. Do you see cyber warfare and the kind of thing Jim Lewis is talking about as a development that helps your argument about the trend to less violence rather than more?
Well, yes, the nature of warfare is changing away from these big pitched battles with tank formations and towards, as you said, sharper, shorter, smaller wars, really, more localized action. And for our American forces, you know, the special forces, special operations and such, and away from these big heavy armies. So I think this is all part of a direction away from the most brutal, most lethal wars historically and towards something that's still brutal and lethal, but in a smaller scale these days.
Okay, no great disagreements, no chair throwing. That's the nature of this program and the nature of this season as well. And thank you all very much. Joshua Goldstein at American University, again, Winning the War on War, The Decline of Armed Conflict Worldwide. Fred Kaplan at Slate.com and at the New America Foundation, book coming up on American military strategy. Michael O'Hanlon at the Brookings Institution, his latest book, The Wounded Giant, America's Armed Forces in an Age of Austerity. And Jim Lewis. Us again with the Commission on Cybersecurity at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thank you all and have a good holiday. I'm Orman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, a broadcast and co-produced by KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.